This is Steve Denning, co-author of Unfiltered Marketing, 5 Rules to Win Back Trust, Credibility, and Customers in a Digitally Distracted World, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I do this podcast to help me and my listeners keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow their revenue. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Stephen Denny to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about the book he has co-authored with Paul Leinberger, Unfiltered Marketing, 5 Rules to Win Back Trust, Credibility, and Customers in a Digitally Distracted World, published by Career Press. Stephen Denny is a competitive strategy and marketing consultant helping emerging brands define their competitive positioning, communication strategies, and implementation plans in the market. He is also the author of Killing Giants, 10 Strategies to Topple the Goliath in Your Industry. Apart from writing and consulting, Stephen is a frequent speaker on competitive strategy and marketing. He holds multiple patents, has lived and worked in both the U.S. and Japan, and has an MBA from the Wharton School. Prior to consulting, he was a 20-plus year senior marketing executive, having managed the people, strategy, and budgets at brand name technology companies like Sony, OnStar, iOmega, and Plantronics. And, interesting fact, he attended university in the small Virginia town of Lexington, which is known for 2 historic institutions of higher learning. And at the same time, Stephen was a student there. The host of the Marketing Book Podcast was a student at the other school next door. Stephen, congratulations on Unfiltered Marketing, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation to come.
So you spent your junior year at Washington and Lee University in Tokyo, where you apparently were the first non-Japanese student ever to play intercollegiate tennis in Japan. Is that true?
Yes, I was the first one ever. They had to bend rules. They had to change their internal processes to allow me to do it. But I was at beautiful, not very bucolic Rikkyo University, right in downtown Ikebukuro. And quite a departure from the highly urbanized setting of Lexington, Virginia.
That's right. That's right. So I was next door at VMI. I was like 1 year ahead of you. So I also noticed you were a Sigma Nu.
Yep.
And do you know a fraternity here in the United States? And do you know where Sigma Nu was founded?
Yes. On the left side of the colonnade, right there by the rock. Probably right in the middle of your campus.
Yes, it was founded at VMI, Virginia Military Institute, by 3 VMI cadets, one of whom became a member of the very first VMI baseball team right after the Civil War. So I don't learn much on this podcast because it's all my head is so filled with really unimportant trivia like that. But at any rate, and I hope the pandemic hasn't affected your the profitability of your Denny's restaurant chain. I understand you're the founder of that as well.
If I was, I'd be writing different books right now, truthfully. I've been asked that question before. You know, when I look at LinkedIn and they tell you, you know, who is searching for you? Every week, someone from Denny's restaurant has looked me up.
Oh, interesting.
Once a week.
Interesting. And I noticed, of course, I read up on this when you're the Marketing Book Podcast host. Not only do you read the books, but you get up to speed on, again, pretty unimportant, worthless trivia, but I noticed that Denny's wasn't even started by somebody named Denny. It was started by somebody named Dan, and his coffee shop was confused with another one in L.A. Sorry, that was my co-host, Monty, the golden retriever. And then they had to change it. Hold on one second. Monty, what's the matter, bud? He's never done that before, so. Okay.
Yeah, I understand.
So, and I also noticed the book is endorsed by Ann Handley, a past guest.
Oh, my goodness.
And so you know this book is well written.
The first woman I ever called editor.
Oh, really?
Ann Handley was, the first writing I ever did that wasn't like for myself was for Marketing Profs way back when.
No kidding.
And she gave me login credentials a day. She rused to this moment, I'm sure. But I wrote for Marketing Profs for a number of years. And she's a wonderful, lovely person.
Yes, and she was one of the very, very first guests on the Marketing Book Podcast about 300 episodes ago. Mm-hmm. And her book, Everybody Writes, has been mentioned so many times, particularly by authors, but it's a terrific book. So the foreword to the book is beautifully written, and it's by none other than Brian Solis. And again, he's a past guest, and I'm a big fan of his. And I just wanted to quote from this. He writes, "Long gone are the days of brand style guides, messaging by committee, jargon, and communications and sales techniques. Stephen Denny and Paul Leinberger are about to take you on a journey to win your trust. But before they can do that, they have to earn your attention. And before they can do that, you have to believe that by giving them your time and focus. They will help you learn something so valuable, something you don't already know or believe you need to learn, or that they offer something more compelling than you can figure out for yourself. The only chance that they have to succeed in winning your trust is to be raw, unscripted, and real with you. If you think about it, the same is true for the people you're trying to engage in your work. If you're reading this book, you probably have something to say or sell or teach. You're hoping to reach a desired audience and help them understand that by connecting with you, they'll be better for it. But ask yourself, why should anyone trust you? Why should anyone give you their attention or give you the gift of earning their trust?" So, Stephen Denny, how is the 2011 killing of Osama bin Laden connected to the birth of what you refer to as this raw information era we're in now?
The killing of Osama bin Laden, to me and to a lot of people, was the first time we reflexively reached for our smartphones instead of our TV remotes. Something was happening. I was sitting down to dinner, and my family was slowly, coming together, and things are cooking in the kitchen over there. And I've got my phone out, and I'm looking at things, and there's noise going on. Something big has happened. And what's going on? Well, the president is going to come on the television here in an hour, in 45 minutes. Something huge has happened. And the Twitter feed starts to speed up. Now, I don't know about you. I don't know about your listeners. I've got thousands of people who are, I'm following and who are firing all these messages off. And all of a sudden, this began to bubble up. It's Osama bin Laden. They've caught him. They've killed him, something. And it all of a sudden comes to a head. And people who are in a position to know are verifying that this is, in fact, the truth. These are not newscasters. These are people in the armed forces, people in Department of Defense, people who are wired into the executive branch of the U.S. government. President Obama didn't show up for another 45 minutes on television. By the time he showed up, we knew what had happened. We, those of us who were sitting there glued to our smartphones, reading our Twitter feed. And to me, that was kind of the modern technological birth of this shift to raw. We no longer had to wait for the president, or we didn't have to wait for a newscaster to come on television to tell us what was going on in the world. We were getting the news direct from the source. And as you peel back the layers of the onion there to the poor Pakistani IT guy trying to get some work done in the middle of the night, and he hears helicopters going overhead, he's the guy who unwittingly blew the lid off of the raid. How crazy is that? So that to me is kind of that seedling bursting through the surface. It said something has just irrevocably changed.
Right. And it reminds me of every time I'm like when I was at the gym before the pandemic and they would have the TV screens up that would show have the news running and you would see the news reader and they were putting up the graphic of a tweet from someone else.
Right.
And I just think, you know, they die a little bit inside when they have to do that because they used to be the ones that were breaking the news. And now they're showing something that all of us may have already seen.
Yeah. So. Yeah. They do die a little bit inside, I think. I think that's true. And I think that's part of what's happened to media. And that's part of what has colored what's happened in business. We have to look at media. We have to look at government. We have to look at news gathering as being on that sort of forefront of how the culture is shifting. But we on the business side of things look at this. And if we squint hard enough, we understand where the public is heading. And we understand what this shifting definition of the shifting expectations of speed, of cycle time, of how quickly we want information, and how quickly news becomes old. Isn't that the crazy thing?
Yes. And also, I have been hearing about these consumer polls about how little the news is trusted. And I mean, that's right up there with marketers and members of Congress. So we're in good company.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about trust. And you write in here, in an age of collapsing trust, when WikiLeaks scandal and fake news from both the public and private sectors dominate our news feeds and where we now have access to the same sources of information that the traditional gatekeepers have historically kept to themselves, the only thing we now trust is us, our own eyes, our own senses, and our own judgment. Talk about this concept of seeking control in an out of control world and this collapse of trust in the institutions around us and our you know resulting or primal drive to regain some sense of control over our lives.
That's a really this is a foundational piece of the research that we've been doing for the last 4 years. When we first launched the Culture and Technology Intersection Study, which is the research that underpins Unfiltered Marketing. We didn't have an agenda. We were looking to answer three big questions. What's the future of the brand-consumer relationship, brand loyalty? What's the future of the digital footprint and how we share our thoughts and talk to the people around us? And what's the future of work? 1, 2, and 3. Those were the three areas of interest that we had. And we put together this broad survey. And we were talking to thousands of respondents in the U.S. and in 11 other countries. And what we saw bubbling up out of this mass of raw data was, first of all, a validation of this collapse of trust. Others have written about this at length, and other research companies have done extremely thorough jobs to vet this. We don't have to argue about this for sure, particularly in 2020. Look at where we are as a nation and a culture right now. We are living in an age of collapsed trust. However, we asked some different questions, and what we found was an important nuance. It's not just a question of we are living in an age of collapsing trust. This is true. What we found is we as a culture, not just in the United States but elsewhere, are unwilling to let it go. We're unwilling to leave it at that. We are attempting as best we can to wrest some sense of control back, whether it's our digital lives or our personal lives. So, for example, yes, I say things like, I'm concerned that smart devices are listening to me. 60% of U.S. respondents said so. Not something we need to really argue about or wonder about because you read the news and you've seen enough examples of this happening. But more importantly, when we ask about how do you feel personally about your prospects in life, we find that self-sufficiency and self-determination have jumped to the fore. Now, this is critically important to focus on just for a second. if you go back a few decades and ask people, how do you define success personally? They're going to answer in the following way. I have a big job. I make lots of money. I got a beautiful house. I got a fast car. 4 years ago, when we launched into this culture and technology intersection study, we saw something really startling. And my partner, Paul Leinberger, has been doing this for 30 or 40 years. So he's looking back across a career at GFK and Futures Company and doing the Global Monitor and the Roper Starch Worldwide type of big consumer trend research. And what do we see jumping to the top? Number one, how do you define health? How do you define your wellness? That's the top predictor of whether you feel you are successful. What comes after that? I have control over my time. I have control over my time. I work for myself. All of these things about self-determination, I have a self-sufficient lifestyle. And then you see a gap. And then you see, oh, yeah, and I also make a lot of money, and I got a big job and a big house and a fast car and all that stuff.
And a podcast.
And a podcast, the ultimate definition of personal fulfillment. So the polarity has flipped. And now it's about, what do I control? So control becomes this central theme that runs through this. I want to have control over my life. Mm-hmm. So we can ask people, hey, do you cover up the webcam on your laptop? Yeah, 42% of Americans do. 42%.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. When I first asked that question, we all kind of rolled our eyes. So who's going to say yes to this? Come on. It's a couple of guys in the basement, you know, with their windows, covered with tinfoil. Mm-hmm. And the answer is no. It was 47% the first time we asked the question. Half of Americans cover their webcam. Wow. To me, that was really kind of striking.
Yeah, so, you mentioned that in the book, and it also brought to mind for me, I don't have a smart speaker in my house. I don't care who it is. It just creeps me out thinking that somebody's listening.
The first time I plugged in my Alexa, it was a gift. My security-obsessed older brother gave me this for Christmas. He said, here, you're going to love it. It's Alexa. I plugged in my little Echo device, and I stared at it for a minute. It kind of stared back at me, and I said, Alexa, are you connected to the NSA? And it said something like, I have to reboot. I have to check my settings. It did not answer my question. And at that moment, I unplugged it. And it's been in a desk drawer, ever since, where it belongs. But here we are. I mean, we're surrounded with smart devices, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah.
I got a smartphone. I got a smart TV. I got microphones and cameras all around me. And as they say, there's no expectation of privacy. And yet here we are, where we have a sizable number of people. 51% of people in the U.S. say they always or sometimes use an encrypted browser. Huh, how about that? Little steps in various directions to wrest back some sense of control. So that underpins everything. Now, because we're living in this age of collapsing trust, because we're trying to get some sense of control back in our lives, the only thing that we trust now is what we can see or hear with our own eyes and ears. We trust our judgment. So all of a sudden, we've shifted from watching television and, depending on how old you are, either Walter Cronkite or Brian Williams or whoever talking to you about the news to, I want to see it for myself, please, because I don't trust you. Here we go. You know, back to the beginning of our conversation here. You see media sources now screen grabbing tweets. What does that mean for traditional media? It means they're no longer in the business of breaking news. They're in the business of interpreting. It's all op-ed now. So suddenly we find ourselves in this situation where we don't turn to traditional media for news, for breaking information anymore. They just put their spin on things.
Yes, and that's why there's not much news in my day, and certainly not any television news. But I now am even more suspicious of any news, meaning, why did they pick that story? And we go from there. So let's talk about Raw. And Stephen Denny, when I mean Raw, I don't mean the 1983 Eddie Murphy movie of his stand-up comedy performance. That was that came out the same year you graduated from Washington and Lee.
It's true.
So explain what you mean when you say that raw means unscripted.
Sure.
And also, you know, unscripting this, you talk about it, the willingness to be vulnerable, which I think is becoming a slightly overused marketing term that people misunderstand, mm-hmm. and they should get a better handle on it by reading your book. And also, make sure to talk about this live streaming. Fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is what springs from seeking control. Because if we are only willing to trust the evidence we see with our own eyes, what this means is I need to see the evidence myself. I want to see the live stream. I want to see the raw data. I want to see the email dump. I mean, I want to read it all, but I want to know what's there. So we've just lived through 11 months of 2020, most of which has been taken up with a pandemic, most of which has been taken up with nationwide civil unrest. And when we see the live stream, someone streaming off their cell phone, so off their smartphone in the street, we see something that belies the narrative that's going on. And the same thing applies now. Now let's shift tracks and get back to a firm marketing footing. What we're looking for is someone to tell us what's going on. I had a wonderful conversation once upon a time. Actually, it was when I was writing Killing Giants back in 2010 with Robert McKee, who, if you're familiar with mm-hmm. the name, he is our nation, our culture, the English language's premier teacher of screenwriting. His students have collected dozens of Oscars and Emmys and Golden Globes, what have you.
Yes, and his name has come up in some of the many books I've had on the show about storytelling.
Indeed. So he is the Yoda of story. And I had a wonderful opportunity to attend his three-day story seminar, which was fantastic. I don't think I have a screenplay in me. I don't think Unfiltered Marketing is going to be a movie.
Well, if there is, I hope that they cast somebody good-looking for the role of the host of the Marketing Book Podcast, because, you know, this will clearly play a big
role.
We've
got Rob Schneider, actually, penciled in. Samuel L. Jackson is in negotiations to play me. It's a surprise casting, but he captures me well, I think.
Yeah.
So here, he said, you know, we got off the subject, and we were talking about storytelling for the small screen, specifically for the boardroom. And he said, he gave me a wonderful quote. And he said, the board has heard every lie imaginable.
Yes.
And having spent enough time in front of boards myself, I stopped me dead. And I said, my God, that's such a great thing to say. Because it's true. They have heard every lie imaginable. And the problem is that marketers, CEOs, entrepreneurs, whoever it is that is standing up in front of that room trying to convince a board of directors, trying to convince a customer, that they've never made a mistake in their lives. Where's thin? And it's not persuasive. What persuades is the truth. And it's so much more persuasive to turn off the laptop and say, listen, we really screwed this up. We didn't see this pandemic coming. We didn't see this competitive move before it happened. And it really took us out of our plan. And we were in trouble. And this is what we did. You know, we pulled ourselves together. We called the meeting. We got a team together and a task force. And we started working the problem. And we pulled ourselves out of the gutter. And we're back on decent footing now. I wish we were further down the road. We're not. But this is where we're at. This is what we've learned. This is where we're going. And you know what? I think it's the right thing to do. That's not a scripted story. And mm-hmm. it's not necessarily vulnerable with the air quotes, right? I'm not saying pity me. I'm saying, listen, I'm not here to tell you that I'm omnipotent and I see everything, because that's the way executives are trained in this culture.
Mm-hmm. And I think it also makes people so suspicious when they see anything too slick and polished now.
Right. Post-production can fix anything. So we want to see unscripted. We want to see unvarnished. We want to see something live and in the moment. Now, there's a caveat to that. And this is such a little interesting digression, because again, we've been doing this research now for 4 years. And when we began, we would ask questions about, I want to see the executive live on camera, flames leaping up behind him, saying, okay, everyone, you know, we don't know what's happening. Ed Bastian, Delta Airlines, great IT failure a couple years ago. Perfect example of this. Saying, we're working the problem right now. We don't know what's going on, but I'm going to update you tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And what we found over the last couple of years is a shift. We're no longer necessarily hoping the CEO will have his hands waving and tie pulled askew. We're okay to wait a day. Just get the facts right. It doesn't have to be a perfectly polished presentation. I still want unscripted. I still want to know what you stand for here. And I want you to take ownership. But I don't need to be with you every second here. Just tell me what's going on. And if it takes a day, I'm fine with that. Now, why is that? You know, it's interesting. People still prefer the live stream. They still prefer to catch it in the moment rather than wait for that slick, beautifully produced video. But what we've seen is a little too much video, a little too much in the moment. And I can speak in terms of the media in general. I can speak in terms of business. You log into LinkedIn, and over the last couple of years, you've seen this mushroom-like profusion of what I generally refer to as high guys videos. And, you know, you're scrolling down the screen and you see a bunch of strangers waving at you. Hi guys, it's someone I've never heard of before. And they're going to tell me something that may or may not be relevant to me. And it happens over and over and over again. And finally, we just kind of said, you know what? I don't need all of this.
I think half of the guys on the videos are telling us how to crush it. Whatever crushing
hustle
is, and whatever hustle. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all hustle. It's all crushing. It's all whatever. And I'm not saying that those are necessarily bad sentiments. I'm just saying enough. I'm distracted enough. I'm busy enough as is. There are those in my circle who have suggested that our president for the last 4 years has contributed to this in that we know his every waking thought. We know exactly what's going on in President Trump's head because he shares it with us. and I did. I mentioned in the book the first time his social media marketing manager discovered that he learned to use Twitter himself. And he had managed the president's Twitter stream and he was very prepared. And all of a sudden, one day he's sitting at his desk and all of a sudden, blip, something came up. He said, I didn't do that. And oh my God, as he said, it was like the moment in Jurassic Park when they realized the velociraptors could open the cage. And it's like, oh my God, you know, so here we are. So it's that kind of.
There wasn't a lot hidden there.
No, not at all. So there was a certain high guys video overload, a certain Trump effect, possibly. But what we've seen now is there is a little bit of backing up, a little bit of curation is necessary. We still want to see it unscripted. We still want to see it raw, but it's okay to get your facts straight before you blurt it out. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a very important nuance, and it's important that we talk about for marketers, particularly those who are dealing with a problem or a crisis. Mm-hmm. It's always been common parlance. Oh, you got to get out in front of it. You got to get on, you know, immediate. There's an asterisk there. And you need to pause for a second because, and this is a shift that's happened over the last, I would say, 2 years. So it's new. And that means you need to get your story right. You need to understand the problem, then communicate. And you do it just the way we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important.
Yeah, there's one other part in that. I think it was in that section that I think is really important for marketers. And you write about transparency. And I was delighted to see that you say that that's becoming somewhat hackneyed. So talk about the difference between transparency, or I guess what the perception of transparency is, versus raw.
Sure. I think, you know, the key issue here is to look at the role of context in all of this. One of my favorite stories in the book, one of my favorite interviews that went into the book was with Rob Chernow, who is the president of programming for A&E Networks. He's the guy who pushed the green light button on Live PD. And if you don't know what Live PD is, this is a television show that took live streams from, I believe it was 6 police departments around the country and fed it into a single hub studio where a panel of 3 law enforcement experts, veterans, were providing kind of play-by-play commentary. I've always likened it to a combination of Cops and Monday Night Football. The show's currently on hiatus. They took it off the air briefly as the unrest was spreading across the country. They've promised to put it back on the air, so hopefully we can look forward to seeing it again. But the key here is, you know, talking to Rob about the future of Raw, the future of unmediated content. And of course, his point, I think, is exactly clear that too much unmediated content is just chaos. We can't make sense of it, particularly if we're not expert in it. So there is a role for that layer of expertise, but we still have to see the raw feed in order for it to sink in. So now when we talk about things like transparency, what does transparency mean at this point? I was going through Boston Airport months ago and going down one of those escalators, people movers from one terminal to another. And I pass an ad from the apparel brand Fjällräven. And it says that its garments are sustainable, ethical, and traceable. And, you know, I wanted to take a photograph of it. Of course, the escalator is moving in the wrong direction. So I'm backing up, right? I'm trying to keep pace with this ad.
Knocking not people down.
Another one. Exactly. Get out of my way. I have to take a photograph.
I'm an author.
Yes. You don't understand. Fortunately, there was one further down, so I was prepared for it.
Okay.
But this idea of being traceable now becomes the next step. It's not just hand-selected and curated. It's artisanal. We have to be traceable now. We have to know where the farm is, where they raise the ducks from which the down is plucked.
Mm-hmm.
I had a great interview with Paul Helgeson, the former CEO of Golden Plump Poultry, which I had the joy of working with at one point in time, my only food client in all of my consulting life. The kind of client you walk in and say, boy, it's hot, and it leads to a 30-minute discussion of how many chickens die every temperature, every degree of temperature over 90 degrees.
Oh, wow.
These guys take it very seriously, yeah. As they would. But, you know, the bottom line being, we had an opportunity to really present a very sharp-edged point of view to them prior to their acquisition that I think some have said possibly contributed to their valuation, which had to do with the elevation of food culture, but importantly, how we could present food in a supermarket environment to a consumer and trace it all the way back to this is the farm. These mm-hmm. are the farmers. Here's Bob and Sue. Here they are. Here's their picture. And you can trace it all the way back. These are not factory farms. So that for the ethical eater, and that is a segment, right? That is a group of people out there in a segmentation study in someone's PowerPoint deck in that industry who says there are a sizable growing number of consumers who very much care about where that farm is, mm-hmm. who those people are, how those animals have been treated. Now, you look at a major brand like Patagonia, and you see that same attention to detail and that same attention to tracing this back so that we understand where things are coming from, and we appreciate that.
And just this week, I saw some headline about Chinese slave labor and the brands Apple and Nike were in the headline. And I don't even know. What's that?
Whoops, I said.
Well, I don't even, I didn't.
Not the headline you want to be in. Speaking of crisis communications, yes.
Yeah, and it's like, whoa, wait a minute. I need to go find it. But I just saw that there, and it's like, wait a minute. Are they using, you know, what do they have a somewhat obscure supply chain? I think what you're saying is that everyone wants to see more of a glass house of their supply chain. One last thing about this section, though. You say that in the future, when a company wants to draw attention to a new product it's launching, it will choose live streaming. Interesting. Why do you think that is? Same reason?
Yep, I think it is. There was a really interesting data point that came out of the last survey where we asked this question about co-development. We asked it about bringing people along in the process, making them part of it, making them feel that they're part of that exclusive group that had some say, no matter how minor, in how a product or a service came to be. I had a great interview in the book with Paul Gaudio, who's the former chief creative at Adidas. And he talked, it was a wonderful turn of a phrase. He said, you have to be swimming in the culture. And he talked about everything from high profile celebrity music artist collaborations to going to a high school on a Friday after school and going to the basketball court and seeing how people interact with your products, inviting people in to say, hey, do you want to be part of a design process? We'll give you the tools. We'll teach you how to look at it. And you know, Paul's vision for design. Everyone talks about co-development. Everyone talks about voice of the customer. How many swim in the culture?
Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you something. I come from a technology background, and every product manager, product marketer has some voice of customer KPI, some performance indicator that pays them out a budget, pays them out a bonus of some sort at the end of a quarter. How many really swim in the culture?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fantastic insight. I mean, once you come across that, you read that interview, you read the way that Adidas has pursued this, you all of a sudden realize you have a lot of work to do. Because, you know, again, I come from a technology background. I don't see that same level of attention paid. There's a huge opportunity to do that. So from a co-development standpoint, it truly means that not only are you getting the best possible market insight, but you're also building in some first person raving brand evangelism.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just recap for the listeners so far. So there's five rules that I mentioned because they're in the subtitle of the book. And rule number one was seeking control in an out of control world. Very important. Rule number two, raw means unscripted. And now you're starting to talk about rule number three. And I'd like you to explain rule number three, raw means in process. Yeah. Which again seems to fly in the face of wanting everything completely buttoned up or buttoned down before any communication starts. Explain this in process rule, which again, just like I said, it seems very counterintuitive for a couple generations of marketers and management that's out there.
I completely agree. It is counterintuitive, and it's a little bit culturally uncomfortable.
Oh.
In process, is this issue of swimming in the culture, of gaining insights and soliciting deep inputs from actual users throughout the process, a true commitment to co-development. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a chance to interview her. I tried my best. Emily Weiss, the founder of Glossier. Here's a billion-dollar valuation cosmetics brand born from a blog where she's giving makeup and beauty tips and collected a community around her that allowed her to launch a brand on the back of this community. And constant interaction and feedback, both digitally and pre-COVID, and hopefully post-COVID, in person.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to live in that culture and get absolute real-time input on formulation, on product design, on new product development is fantastic. I mean, what an incredible luxury for a brand to have. And I think that, particularly in this day and age, you know, to talk about the impact of technology on culture, the ability to create a community around a central idea, not necessarily your speeds and feeds and your product, but the concept, the idea bigger than the narrow definition of your product or even your brand, that can become an absolutely undeniable, unarguable competitive advantage.
And on page 60, you talked about how no one ever lost because they were too close to the customer. And that should be carved in stone along with several other lines from your book. But that concept you just talked about was covered in great detail in another book on the show a couple years ago called Content Inc. by Joe Polizzi, founder of the Content Marketing Institute. And he talked about there are a lot of great companies out there now that are first building an audience and then delivering the products.
Right.
And they're doing that because they really understand their audience first. And they get so much great, you know, in-process feedback from their happy, loyal audience members or customers. But I mean, is it even possible for a corporate culture that's based on, you know, secrecy and, you know, need to know to even shift to a culture where you're
well, there it is. There it is. That's the big question. I mean, it is a cultural shift. And some cultures are going to be very uncomfortable with this idea. Some cultures are going to be very uncomfortable with raw in general. But this whole concept of being in process, of sharing the process. Look at BMW. They decided to share their design process with the world. And this was BMW Design Center is Fort Knox. It's like the Pentagon. It's one of the top secret crown jewels of the company. How do we design products? And could we let a camera crew in to look at our clay models and things like that? And BMW made the decision to produce a series of YouTube videos that showed this process. And they're very spare and sparse. It's just a music bed, but they're showing how the process goes. And it has been the most interacted with set of videos they've ever produced. Mm-hmm. And the comments coming out of these videos are like, you know what? I bought a 5 series, I bought a 7 series, and I feel so much better about it now that I see exactly what goes into designing these products. So it's that sort of thing where we can say, look, I know this is extremely confidential, but it's really not. They don't care. The world is not going to shift on its axis because you showed someone how you design a product.
Yeah, you're going to actually build trust and the participation that you're talking about. And there'll probably be more and more that do this, but there's going to be a number of executive retirements before this starts to take hold. And it would seem like if you're, well, just like the subtitle of your first book, you know, killing the industry giant, that topic, it seems like if you're a challenger, it's going to be easier to do this than if you're just...
Well, it might be. And here's the ray of hope in all of this. Regardless of the culture that you work in today, if you see value in this idea and it makes sense to you, it's your job to find a way to take small voluntary steps in the right direction. You don't have to jump from complete lockdown secrecy to complete openness in one bound, because that's hard.
Yeah, and I would say you, in answer to that executive, and I've heard them say this before we start a content marketing effort, they say, well, we don't want to share our secret sauce. Well, first off, you know, that's another topic. I'm not sure anybody has secret sauce, but that's not probably what people are most interested in anyway. if they want to become more engaged. So let me just read this one summary, very nicely done, about this whole in process. In process illustrates how we as users want to be part of the process because we can be part of the process by virtue of our technologically connected lives and our interest in frequent communication from the brands we care about. We have a desire for inclusion. We want to be included because it connects us personally, exclusively to the outcome where an outsider would feel no personal connection at all. This is a deeply personal phenomenon that exists only because of how we've evolved to best coexist with the technology we've come to rely on. So let's talk about rule number four, which is raw means in context. And I thought this chapter had the most implications for people in marketing and sales. And there was just, there were so many great quotes that I just wanted to scream from the mountaintops. Like, in context means we want to understand the backstory before we choose to trust. We want to understand why things are the way they are to understand the history, the rules, the pedigree, the probabilities that underpin what we're asked to accept. If we can teach our audience how to best interpret what they're seeing so they're more expert than they were before, we can rely on their own judgment to come to the right decisions with some confidence. We're no longer just lecturing our audience. We're giving them the context behind our thinking so they can make up their own minds. And there were just so many things in there about, there's also another one about teaching your customers. So say more about this, about how raw means in context, because I thought that was probably the most important rule for marketers and salespeople to take away right now.
It absolutely is. I mean, this is the heart and soul. If you're a salesperson, you probably intuitively know this, and I'll put a label on it for you so you can punch the button on purpose. But the entire idea of being in context means we have shifted from trying to be the hero here, right, to moving beside our audience and whispering in their ear. Both of us looking at the same body of evidence, our role now changed from the zero sum I win, you lose, to me teaching you how to interpret the data that we're both looking at. This is critically important. This isn't me telling you that my product is better. This is me standing next to you saying, let's look at some side-by-side technical comparisons. Let's look at end-user testing. Let's look at whatever body of evidence I'm presenting to you, my customer. I'm going to teach you how to interpret this data. I'm going to make you an expert. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, if I flip back 10 years and I look at Killing Giants, which was my first book, I had an interview with Jim Cook of the Boston Beer Company. And it was absolutely fascinating because he said something that I felt every marketer, every salesperson needed to hear. You know, he didn't set out to brew the best beer. He said, I want to change how Americans think about beer. There's a huge difference here. It's not me satisfying myself. It's not even me winning awards with my product. I want to change how you think. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to teach you what makes this wonderful, vibrant, 10,000-year-old human tradition so fascinating. Everyone in his company, everyone in the Boston Beer Company has two jobs. It's like the Army. Everyone has a corporate job and everyone has a brewery job. Most of their employees are home brewers. What is that? Does that make any sense at all? Hmm. They can walk out of that building every night with a six-pack of Sam Adams Boston Lager, right? I'm assuming that that's true. Jim, correct me if I'm wrong. But he's teaching them, he's encouraging them to be home brewers because he wants them to understand the process absolutely from the ground up. And the way he describes it is, I want them to get it under their fingernails. And now we take that forward and we say, in context, great. Here's the LA Lakers and their Court Vision app. And they're using a tremendous data set, artificial intelligence driven, real time analytics that show basketball players moving down the court. They're showing probability of shot selection, of shot probability in real time. And they're teaching people who are watching through their smartphones to become expert in how basketball is done. That is unbelievable. It's in its early days at this red hot second. But now, you know, back up. We just talked about Rob Chernow and A&E Networks Live PD. We're watching police work in process right now with a 4-second delay. And our 3-person in studio panel is explaining what's happening, explaining what the process is, as well as doing a little bit of color commentary.
Mm-hmm.
So here, we're not telling you what it is. We're letting you watch the evidence unfold. And we're whispering in your ear, making you an expert. Isn't that a difference?
Yes. And that's interesting about the Boston Beer Company. I am not a home brewer, but I have done extensive product testing of their product.
That's a burden that we all share.
Well, you know, I suffer for my art, but there's just a couple of the things I want to mention from this chapter before we wrap up from this rule number 4. Marketers run the risk of drowning our audiences in content in the hope that viewers will somehow parse through the sea of information we've given them and find the truth on their own. But this is a dangerous assumption and one we should avoid. As information on every possible topic has come online and thus available to anyone with a browser, we might also venture to guess that our intellectual curiosity as a culture has shrunk almost as much as our collective attention span. And then later on the page, you write, we need to help our customers connect the dots. In other words, it's not that they're stupid. It's that they're busy, distracted, and largely indifferent to our goals as marketers. As such, we need to make decisions about how to provide context to frame up what is educational and what is noise. And you then go on and towards the end, and I just wanted to quote from this and ask you to explain, because I think this will be really of great interest to most people listening. You write, marketing has become a bad word for a number of reasons, some well-earned. The hard sell, the slippery nature of much of what we see on a daily basis, the always-on, act-now nature of the lowest quartile of marketing has unfortunately cast us all as snake oil promoters to some degree. And that reminded me years ago, back when we did more advertising, and if advertising still worked really well, we'd be doing more of it. But I remember we did work for a personal injury law firm, and it was really good work and really made the phone ring and helped them grow their practice. And it was a very different approach. It showed these testimonials of how people's lives had been helped after a terrible injury. And it was very, very compelling. And I met lawyers later, you know, various functions, and they would ask what I did, and I'd happen to mention that. And they said, you know, I hate, and this might have been a corporate lawyer, and they'd say, I hate personal injury law advertising, and I hate the brush that paints all of us with. That's the only personal injury lawyer advertising I've seen that makes me proud to be a lawyer. So I thought of that when I read this. But how, you know, against this backdrop of distrust, yeah, could you say any more about how we win over a jaded audience?
Well, your example right there illustrates the point, I think, very well. How many years ago was that?
Oh, probably 10 years ago.
Yeah, 10 years ago. So here we are at a slightly earlier era of technological immersion. And what you did is show evidence. And probably in a fairly unscripted fashion.
Oh, completely. And I remember saying to the attorneys, how would you guys feel about not being in your TV commercial?
Yeah. Ego, yeah. Right? Not being the hero anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We're teaching them, and no one sells a peer like a peer. So what you did intuitively was seize upon this unscripted idea and also you know, really giving them a wonderful lesson in context as well. This is what other people have experienced. We're looking at the data, looking at the evidence, which in this case is a person speaking about their experience. So that in and of itself, I mean, it is true. We are overwhelmed. And going back to the Rob Chernow conversation, you know, I asked him, what is the future? What does the future of media look like? And he said, you know, I say this with a little caution, but it's curation. We need that layer. We need to ensure that this fire hose of information, this raw content on our Twitter feeds, on our social feeds, wherever it happens to be, doesn't just become a cacophony. We need to put some layer of understanding on it. Now, again, they're still looking at the raw feed. So it's not us seizing the camera and being in our own ad, to your point. It's us teaching. This is what you're seeing. But this is the evidence itself. Let me help you understand this raw information that's firing at you. Because without that, we are distracted. We are busy. We have our own concerns. We also have 5,000 people we follow on Twitter. And we have 15 different social platforms. And the phone is ringing, and my mobile is buzzing, and I have email coming in.
And Monty, the golden retriever, is barking.
And the dog is barking. But here we are, you know, and this is the truth of the matter. And here, you know, in an age of COVID, you know, what percentage of it? Half of us have kids doing homeschooling upstairs.
Yeah. And I should add, for the listeners' benefit, you, your wife, your kids have all now recovered from COVID.
Oy. That's another story for another day.
Yeah, my goodness. Well, I hope you're doing well. And we actually, so the listener knows, hey, I'm taking them inside here. I'm showing, you know, I don't mean to make fun of the
book. At the level of raw you don't even want to go to.
That's right. Yeah. No, what I was saying, we actually had to cancel this interview a couple times until you were able to get off the couch and and feel better. So I appreciate you being able to do that. Last rule is heroic credibility. And this was, again, very, very interesting and very newsworthy. Explain what heroic credibility is. And I also want to talk about some of the big mistakes that companies are making.
Yeah. Heroic credibility is an interesting one because it has gone through some interesting twists and turns over the last 4 years. Again, this is based on a four-year tracking study, the Culture and Technology Intersection Study that we've been running at Denny Lineberger Strategy. And we started off with the premise of sort of brand bravery. And we're looking at brands that have made powerful statements and then have either been challenged in public or through social media and have either stuck to their guns or have backed down. That mm-hmm. was the first version of this. And as the years went on, we got much more engaged, really. It became much more interesting. Our clients, quite frankly, had much more interest in understanding brand values alignment. So what's fascinating to me is that 2016, 2017, we saw this increasing interest and support for brands that take somewhat strident or even controversial positions on social or political issues. And then suddenly in 2018, the number dropped in half. It had mid-50s support, and it dropped to mid-20s support.
Hmm.
And we thought, something's wrong here. You know, this was this stuck out. And we went back to our data scientists and said, I think you guys made a mistake. Could you please check your math? And they said, sure, of course. Yeah, that looks pretty crazy. And they came back to us, you know, several hardworking days later and said, not only do we stand behind our math, we're willing to say on the record that we have put our finger on an absolutely unique shift in consumer sentiment. We hit peak outrage. What happened? Well, it's always seductive to look at a quantitative shift in consumer sentiment, and then go fill in the blanks subjectively. So I'll do it.
Please, we're on the edge of our chairs here.
I'll do it anyway. It was, looking back at research into the collapse of trust, right back to the beginning of our conversation. We don't trust the media. We don't trust the government. We don't trust academia. We don't trust all of these different institutions around us. Against that backdrop, a number of big thought leaders, think tanks, and others said the words, "It is now up to business, industry, to take up the mantle of truth and lead us on these big societal issues." And into that vacuum stepped brands, and a very large number of them fell flat on their faces as a result. And I truly believe that's what caused this fall down, this collapse in this number.
So an example would be Gillette or Dick's Sporting Goods or Pepsi, something like that?
Absolutely. Those are great examples. You see Nike in their Colin Kaepernick ad. Now, this was well reported out by the brand. Kudos to them for explaining themselves. Mm-hmm. This seems to have been done on purpose. And for those who aren't familiar, he's a very polarizing figure in American sports, a former NFL quarterback who has walked away from the game largely to become an activist. And in the process has taken very controversial stands on defunding the police, etc. So to use him as the face of your brand, even for a fairly finite marketing campaign, was a bit of a lightning rod. Nike was a brand that had been doing and continues to do just about everything right. So this was an interesting decision on their part. I can't point to that and say this was a mistake because they knew their market quite well. They were willing to sacrifice those who are more pro-police in order to attract more mind share from those who think more like he does.
Mm-hmm. And did that affect their earnings in a positive way?
I mean, it did not damage their brand. It did not damage their earnings. Again, this is a company that is doing just about everything right. Mm-hmm. This was not a huge campaign. It got more traction from marketers on Twitter than it did from consumers in the world.
Yeah.
But what we do see are brands like Patagonia. And I love talking about Patagonia. Yvon Chouinard has been saying the same. He's been delivering the same message since the 70s. And when Patagonia says, "Don't buy this jacket, repair it," we'll give you a way to do that. Go to our website and we will repair your Patagonia garments for you. He's talking about sustainability. This is a message that he's been delivering persuasively since before most of his customers were born. When he says, "The president stole your land," talking about Bears Ears National Park in Utah, it's understandable given who he is, the message and DNA of Patagonia, and the customers who buy his stuff. You're not going to see a lot of Patagonia customers in deep red America. This is a company and an ethos that is absolutely baked into the DNA. And kudos for him. He's been beautifully consistent throughout this time because it is coming right from his heart. And it was funny. I mean, he's quoted, I've heard him say this. He said a lot of brands come off as inauthentic because deep down they're simply inauthentic. Right. Period. There you go. Yeah. I mean, that summarizes the whole thing. And this is the landmine waiting for many marketers who want to play in these waters but haven't thought it through.
Yes, this is the chapter they need to read to be careful because there are clearly mines just below the surface. You write, "Heroic credibility speaks to the willingness of brands and leaders to make bold statements that clearly, unmistakably lay out their philosophy and values, and then in the face of criticism from the inevitable social media-fueled wolf pack, refuse to back down." And an example I found interesting was Gillette. They did this campaign about toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
And apparently it just really backfired. And I get, long story short, that really wasn't what they were all about. They were just trying to jump on the bandwagon.
Well, I don't know if they were trying to jump on a bandwagon or not. This was someone's idea of a good spot. And what happened was, as you know, the lead up to the Super Bowl in that particular year, the backlash was so negative and so severe. They'd launched the ad on YouTube, and the negative reviews swamped the positive reviews. I saw the ad. We all saw the ad at one point or another, and it just made me shake my head. You don't need to badmouth an entire gender in order to get your point across. And I think that's the way many people interpreted the ad. So they had to pull it out of the Super Bowl, a rather major marketing milestone in any American brand's marketing calendar, and somewhat lick their wounds afterwards. So that's an example. Another example, which I believe you mentioned a few moments ago, Dick's Sporting Goods. And again, it's not that anyone would take issue with taking a stand against violence. We all take a stand against violence, regardless of our politics, our creeds, whatever. But in order to publicly announce one's intentions as anti-Second Amendment, which of course is the right to bear arms in the United States, the consumer backlash cost them $250 million at the cash register. So there are certain brands. Look at Patagonia again. That's just a wonderful example because it's such a pure example. They live and breathe right down to the cellular level what that idea is. You ask Patagonia, what is your purpose for being here? And they say, it's our job to save the planet, not to make apparel. Okay. But if you're not that brand and you want to make a stand, you want to make a statement. A lot of brands got fouled up on this during the summer, during the civil unrest surrounding police brutality and the Black community. Everyone felt compelled to make a statement. Most of them, truthfully, got run through the ringer in public opinion because they simply have no credibility in this conversation. It's not good enough to simply lay out the fact that you believe that such and such is important when there is no background, no history, no credibility to the conversation. And that's where so many brands have gotten themselves fouled up. They end up just looking foolish at worst or ignored at best.
Right. And as I recall with Dick's Sporting Goods, they were a very large retailer of firearms. And after some shootings here in the United States, they said, we're going to stop selling this AR platform, this particular type of rifle. And the outrage from their gun buying customers was swift and severe. And then, as I recall, the gun manufacturers said, oh, all right, we'll tell you what, we're not going to let you sell any of our stuff in your store. So they were, but if they had always taken that position, that was part of their DNA, that would have made perfect sense. But this was
it would have made tons of sense.
Yeah.
That's exactly the point. They had never stepped out in that direction before. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it became a pet. And this is the lesson. This is the lesson. This was a deeply held belief of their now former CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, okay, we all have deeply held beliefs.
Yeah.
And it was important to him. And he transposed that into his brand. And those two things don't always fit. So herein lies the lesson. This can become an exercise in ego. It's going back to your commercial, you know, is it okay not to appear in your ad? You don't have to appear in your ad. Your personal values are not necessarily your company's personal values. And you got to be very careful here because unless it is ownable and believable and important to your audience, your market, your customers, whatever the stand is that you want to take, if it isn't those three things, you are absolutely taking your brand equity and you are putting it at risk.
Yes. And it's reminds me of, it seems like years ago, within the last 10 years maybe, but there was this term called greenwashing.
Mm-hmm.
Where companies would proclaim their interest in the environment, but they they had never done that before, but they saw everyone else doing it. And their more importantly, their operations didn't indicate that they were doing anything than they had been doing in the past. So related to this, before we wrap up, I wanted to talk about what you call values-driven brands. And this was, again, very interesting to me. You're right, there's been a good deal of discussion lately about the importance of brand purpose. Brand purpose is expressed in the marketing literature as a higher order reason for a brand to exist than just making a profit. Simon Sinek, the top evangelist for brand purpose, has a succinct definition. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And then you go on to write, we agree with Sinek that people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. However, instead of starting with purpose, we suggest starting with values. People don't buy what you do, they buy what you value. Explain.
Brand values underpin this whole conversation as it relates to heroic credibility. And in order to best address that, we talk about going back and saying, is it ownable? Is it believable? Is it important? So often in this conversation, this goes back to the caution I just put out. It's dangerous for us as brand stewards to venture forth in the market, projecting our own personally held values. And when we've asked consumers, people out there in the world, which direction brands should take. And again, this is a generic question. Which brands? We're not specifying whether it's a consumer packaged goods or an auto brand. We're saying all things being equal. Do you want brands to be projecting their values forward, or should they spend more time understanding our values?
Yes.
We see this huge shift, and we see people saying, yes, please. Would you just listen to us instead of lecturing us? Yes. What, that to me, again, back up in our conversation, busy, noisy, distracted consumers. The marketing profession itself and the advertising and the digital ads and the tweet stream, all of this stuff getting us to do something. And now we layer on top of this brands that are lecturing us. Is this really what we want? Well, 3/4 of consumers say it would be great if you'd understand my values.
Yes. And in the book, one of my favorite parts that I underlined a couple times is you talked about the importance of developing brand values based on your customers rather than yourself. Which,
think of the conversation we just had about Glossier. The conversation we had about, you know, these brands that have developed communities before they develop products. Isn't that the heart and soul of that question?
And isn't that what you talk about as it relates to the term brand militancy? Mm-hmm. More about lecturing your customers rather than understanding them. And I evidently you've got the quantitative data to back this up.
Yes. I mean, brand militancy is the word, the expression that we used to frame up this idea of brands that insist on taking strident positions on social and political issues, regardless of whether we, the buying public, wants to hear it or not.
Right. Now, enough. It works when they're in touch with their customers.
It can, yes. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
But not usually, I can see.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why you talk about it being so, a lot of ego involved there. Just a couple other quick questions. Explain for folks what experience design is, and obviously the whole, entire books on the show have been about this, but explain what experience design is and why that's so important.
Well, again, from a consumer experience standpoint, designing those touch points and refining based on this framework that we've sort of seen emerge from this 4 years of research, gives us a different lens through which we can see the way consumers are interacting with our products and services. So experience design, as we would look at it, looking at unfiltered marketing and the research behind it, goes through this layer of seeking control in an out-of-control world. How many different ways can we push control back into our customers' hands? Something that's desperately desired here. How can we present our actions and our plans in process so that our consumers are not experiencing it at the end in a big aha where it's just another piece of noise, but they are part of a community. And there are multiple touch points along the way. And if all of this is underpinned with shared values, well, that to me wraps it up in a nice bow, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me is this modern framework. One of the interesting things that I found, and this really was a bit of an epiphany, maybe just for me, I don't know. But as we were going through this into the fourth year of the research, we had a number of these trends that we had identified, these three that we've written into this book being, I think, the most important. And it became clear that while each one was individually important, when we viewed all three of them together as a holistic system, all of a sudden we realized, you know, we saw this playbook emerge, that it's really all three together define what that future of the brand consumer relationship is. What is the future of brand loyalty? Well, here it is. We just discussed it.
Yeah. And you also explain why brand loyalty is so ineffective now.
Yeah, exactly.
you lay that out too. Well, so the rules are seeking control in an out of control world. Raw means unscripted. Raw means in process. Raw means in context and heroic credibility. So, Stephen, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
If there was one thing to take away from this, I would say that technology has emerged as the single most profound cultural driver in the world today. Culture, right? Technology is a cultural driver. It has literally changed how our brains work. So, we, business people, marketers, salespeople, CEOs, we need to think about the human side of this equation, how their definition of trust and credibility and authenticity and how their values have changed. This is not about layering yet more technology onto the stack. They need to fix how they approach the humans, and the rest is going to take care of itself. I have no idea why this would be a revolutionary idea.
Well, I think it requires some empathy on the part of the companies, because when I read through the book, it's you were describing me. Even at the beginning of the interview, where I said, "Yeah, I don't even want a smart speaker in my house because it just creeps me out that somebody could be listening." So, what is just one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the many ideas from your book that we've talked about?
I'll pick one. There's several.
Absolutely.
Here's what you need to do today, right now. Find a way to get your ego out of the way and go unscripted and unfiltered. Just talk to your audience without your lawyers and your PR people waving their hands telling you to stop. What you think is terribly confidential probably isn't very confidential. Use some common sense. Your results may vary. But by all means, whether we're talking about raw, whether we're talking about being unscripted, whether we're talking about being in process, whether we're talking about brand values alignment, so much of this comes back to a command and control beginning. And one thing we have to get rid of is this rigid adherence to protecting what needs to be shared.
Yes. And if we can get our egos out of the way, that's probably some of the best life advice, Stephen.
Yeah, probably so.
In terms of leadership or dealing with your customers or your family or others. Yeah, there was an entire book about that topic on the show a couple of years ago by Ryan Holiday, Ego is the Enemy. Yeah. And he explained how that's really probably the most destructive force on earth is egos. So what books have most inspired your work and career?
I would say, without question, the first book that has most influenced me is Bob Cialdini's Influence, Science and Practice.
Yes.
I've given away more copies of that book than I could probably physically lift. That has been a constant source of inspiration to me. I had the opportunity to work with Bob years ago Stay in touch to this day to a number of the Cialdini Method certified trainers I've met. That book is critically important. And if your listeners haven't read it, go out and buy it and read it. That's very important. I'll give you another one. Steve Feinberg, an old mentor and friend of mine, wrote a book called The Advantage Makers. He is like Bob Cialdini, a PhD in psychology. He's taken a very unique slant on high performance in the corporate environment and what makes certain people more effective than others. And I had the chance to work with him actually as an executive. His book, Advantage Makers, is on my desk as we speak right now. It's a wonderful read, and it's something worth looking at.
Yeah, The Advantage Makers, How Exceptional Leaders Win by Creating Opportunities Others Don't. Terrific.
Wonderful book, and a fascinating guy. Others, you know, honestly, I'd be remiss if I didn't throw in my favorite new bestseller, Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. It's been on the bestsellers list now for about 2,000 years.
Right.
How to deal with a life of business. There's not much better than the opening, you know, the opening lines of Meditation. And today I will be meeting with ill will, insolence, indifference, and hostility, all of which is due to the offender's ignorance of what is good and evil.
Yes. And it's funny you mentioned that because Ryan Holiday has become one of the biggest proponents of stoicism and talking about that. And also brings to mind a couple of years ago, I interviewed Perry Marshall, and he was saying, I think you should read things that were around before the printing press.
Mm-hmm.
Because that means they were really good to have made it all this way. And I thought that was a very interesting approach.
It's an important book. You know, people ask me about business books and which ones are important to read. And I have to be honest, personally, from my personal standpoint, half the books I recommend have nothing to do with business. Meditations being an excellent example of one. I read a unit history of Julius Caesar's 10th Legion, written by an author named Stephen Dando Collins. I've got it in my library next door, which is probably as good a book on leadership and growing a team as I've ever read in my life. I think it's called Caesar's Legion. It's just a wonderful book on how to talk about raising a legion of raw recruits and training them and turning them into a world-class organization. That's a fantastic read as it relates to anyone in a leadership position, particularly if they're new. On the other side of the coin, and you know, back into the classic business genre, Larry Bossidy and Ram Charan's Execution is one of the best business books I've ever read on the subject of leading effort and being a boss, how to execute in a corporate environment. It's a tremendous book. I got a whole bunch of them here. But
that's
Paco Underhill. Okay. Paco Underhill, Why We Buy.
Mm-hmm.
About evidence-based cultural anthropology in a retail environment. He is the great guru of our modern age on this subject. Absolutely. If you're in any business that impacts retail, following Paco Underhill and what he's doing and what he's saying, either in his books or on his feed, critically important.
Yeah, now even more.
Certainly helped me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Are there any recent or upcoming books that you have heard of or that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
Well, I'm looking at a couple. My graduate alma mater has a professor and prolific author, Adam Grant, who's got a book coming out called Think Again, The Power of Knowing What You Don't Know. Which looks fantastic.
Yes.
Jeff Schwartz has a new book called Work Disrupted, Opportunity, Resilience and Growth in the Accelerated Future of Work. I've done a ton of research in the future of work. And I think this is going to be fascinating here. Yes, I would love to promote Steve Feinberg's next book, but he hasn't put a title on it yet.
Oh.
So you'll have to stay with us on that one.
Okay.
And I would be remiss if I didn't include, and I'm remiss in not having read this yet, but the very generous and gracious author of our foreword, Brian Solis's book, Life Scale, which talks very much about this central theme that runs through Unfiltered.
Mm.
So future and recent past.
Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable and all those books. And Steve gets that book title, we'll even include that. We can go back and update it later. And we're going to include links to your sites and your LinkedIn profile and all that, so listeners can connect with you and thank you for joining us on the show. And for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is Unfiltered Marketing, 5 Rules to Win Back Trust, Credibility, and Customers in a Digitally Distracted World. The authors are Stephen Denny and Paul Leinberger. Stephen, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Doug, it was a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for your patience.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world and I'll drop it in the mail. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And remember the words of the entrepreneur and author Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune." Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.